KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Just 10 days away from inauguration, Donald Trump becomes the first president to be sentenced as a felon.
But he received an unconditional discharge, meaning he'll face no fines and no prison time.
Today is Friday, January 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the Supreme Court signals it may uphold a ban on TikTok.
The bottom line, Your Honor, is this case ultimately boils down to speech. What we're talking about is ideas.
Also, has the response to LA wildfires been hampered by workplace diversity programs?
No fire agency is going to sacrifice training in fundamental fire control, fundamental operations, at the expense of DEI training.
And we asked the co-chair of the Meta Oversight Board for his reaction to news that Meta is dropping fact-checking in the U.S.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As fires continue to burn in Los Angeles tonight, questions are mounting about whether more resources might have made a difference. It's prompted some finger-pointing and investigations, but it doesn't change the reality for thousands who've lost everything in the fast-moving fires. McKenna Sievertson is a reporter for the LAist and says it's hit close to home.
Communities are really rallying around each other, and that's kind of been a bright spot, at least for me personally. For example, in Pasadena, where our newsroom is based, a shelter is just overwhelmed with donations. The Humane Society parking lot is overflowing with supplies after taking in animals, and people across the area are just offering up whatever space they have. So the support is there right now when it is so desperately needed.
Reporter McKenna Sievertson, the wildfires, many of which are still mostly uncontained, have damaged or destroyed more than 10,000 structures, claimed at least 11 lives, and likely caused tens of billions of dollars in damage. Smoke from the deadly fires in Los Angeles is forcing a lot of unhealthy air on people, and interest is spiking in air purifiers. NPR's Bill Chappell has that story.
With much of the L.A. area covered by a red zone of unhealthy air quality, people are looking for ways to avoid breathing smoke. A big concern is the fine inhalable particulate matter that can lodge deep in our lungs. To clean indoor air, experts say you should use filters rated at MERV 13 or higher if your home's HVAC system can handle it. Portable HEPA air purifiers are also good. And online, people are sharing ways to improvise, like using air filters to make a cube around a box fan. If you go outside in smoky conditions, you should wear an N95 mask and drink plenty of water to help your body deal with irritating pollution. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
Publication by the Islamic State does not claim responsibility for the New Year's Eve attack in New Orleans that killed 14 people. It does, however, affirm the man behind the operation was inspired by ISIS materials. More from NPR's Odette Youssef.
An editorial in the Islamic State's weekly newsletter praises the attack, but it indicates that the organization had no knowledge that it was coming. Colin Clark, a counterterrorism expert with the Soufan Group, says this is highly concerning because it means online ISIS materials were sufficient to inspire the attacker to think of the operation on his own.
This is set it and forget it. Like, this is the realization of exactly what they're hoping to achieve.
Clark says this model is really difficult, if not impossible, to stop, especially if a would-be terrorist has good operational security, as he says the New Orleans attacker did. Odette Youssef, NPR News.
Better than expected December jobs numbers. The Labor Department reporting employers added 256,000 jobs last month, well above the 150,000 that were forecast. Wall Street, however, was unimpressed. The Dow fell 696 points today. You're listening to NPR. Sales of electric and hybrid vehicles in China increased by more than 40% last year. NPR's Owen Chow reports demand for the new energy cars is booming, even as companies are locked in a tough price war.
China's electric vehicle market has grown rapidly in recent years, driven in part by generous government subsidies. In 2024, nearly 11 million new energy vehicles were sold in China, making up almost half of all retail car sales, according to the China Passenger Car Association. By comparison, Such vehicles accounted for just 8% of sales in the U.S. market last year, says market researcher Cox Automotive. As the world's largest EV market and producer, China's EV companies face fierce competition at home and pressure on exports. The European Union has raised concerns, claiming that extensive state support for Chinese carmakers has led to unfair competition, undercutting local competitors. Alwyn Tao, NPR News, Beijing.
Some better-than-expected quarterly earnings numbers from drugstore chain Walgreens today. The company's shares soared after leaders told analysts they've made progress toward improving the company, but comes to a major concern, shrinking prescription reimbursements. The company also said it plans to close some of its stores to better align with anticipated goals going forward. Walgreens has about 8,500 stores in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, as well as several thousand in Europe and Asia. The company plans to shutter 500 stores this year. Crude oil futures prices moved higher, oil up 65 cents a barrel to end the session at $76.57 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
On a Friday. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers.
Therefore, at this time, I impose that sentence to cover all 34 counts. Sir, I wish you Godspeed as you assume your second term in office. Thank you.
New York Judge Juan Merchan sentenced President-elect Donald Trump today for concealing payments to a porn star to influence the 2016 election. Trump's sentence of unconditional discharge means he'll have no jail time, probation, or fines, but it does mean the criminal trial has left him a sentenced, convicted felon 10 days before he takes the oath of office. NPR's Andrea Bernstein was in the courtroom and joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Andrea, tell us what it was like in court today.
In some ways, this was just like the trial. Lots of reporters, lots of prosecutors. But on the other side of the room, it was completely different. Trump and his attorney, Todd Blanche, Trump's nominee to be the number two person in the Justice Department, addressed the court via video link from Mar-a-Lago. But more than that, there was no mystery. So throughout this case, which started years ago, we didn't know, would Trump be charged, tried, convicted? But today we knew the outcome because last week the judge said there would be no jail time.
I mean, this was an ordinary moment in a trial, but an extraordinary moment for the country. What did we hear from Trump? How do you respond?
So I've been to a lot of white-collar sentencing, and this was nothing like any of them. Usually the defendant's lawyers present testimonials of their client's good character, argue this was an aberration, and beg for leniency. Typically, defendants say they're sorry. Instead, Trump was defiant. He attacked the legal process, and he attacked the prosecutors.
The fact is that I'm totally innocent. I did nothing wrong.
Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, said he'd be appealing.
What did you hear from the prosecutors? I mean, did they just accept all of this?
Basically, yeah, they accepted the sentence, but they did take the opportunity to issue a warning. Prosecutor Josh Steinglass said, quote, "Instead of preserving, protecting, and defending our constitutionally established system of criminal justice, the defendant, once and future president of the United States, has engaged in a coordinated campaign to undermine its legitimacy."
And what did we learn, if anything, about Judge Merchan's reasoning behind the sentence of unconditional discharge?
Of all the judges who presided over Trump-related trials in New York, Merchan was the most deliberative. You could see him taking into account all sides, and his decision today was like that. In his order last week, Merchan was tough on Trump and his lawyers. He said this was a serious crime Trump was convicted of, that it has what lawyers call gravamen, precisely because, quote, "it was the premeditated and continuous deception by the leader of the free world that is the gravamen of this offense." But today, Merchan said he had no choice, that although Trump was, quote, "an ordinary defendant," the office he is going to inhabit is not.
So was he saying that a president is above the law?
Not exactly, but Judge Merchant did say this.
And it was the citizenry of this nation that recently decided that you should once again receive the benefits of those protections, which include, among other things, the Supremacy Clause and presidential immunity.
The trial ended before the U.S. Supreme Court's decision granting Trump broad immunity in the January 6th case, and Merchant's consistently said since that high court opinion had no bearing on this case. But today, Merchant seemed to gesture that once elected, a president does have special protections. Even so, Trump becomes the first U.S. president to enter office a convicted felon.
That's right, a convicted felon. NPR's Andrea Bernstein, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, when Donald Trump does return to the White House later this month, he will inherit, among other things, a very solid job market. Today we learned that U.S. employers added more than 250,000 jobs last month. That is better than forecasters were expecting. NPR's Scott Horsley is here with details on that jobs report and what it might mean for the overall economy. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Okay, so 2024, it sounds like from a jobs point of view, it ended on a high note.
Yeah, it really did. All told, the U.S. economy added more than 2.2 million jobs last year. That is a bit of a slowdown from 2023, when employers added about 3 million jobs, but it's very good. It's more jobs than we added back in 2019, for example, before the pandemic. Julia Coronado, who's with Macro Policy Perspective, says this was really encouraging news.
I can't find anything wrong with this report. Job gains were not only strong, but they were broader based than they've been. There aren't really any signs of weakness outside of manufacturing. And the unemployment rate declined, even though more people were looking for work.
More than 200,000 people joined or rejoined the U.S. workforce last month, and a lot of them found jobs, and that pushed the unemployment rate down to a low 4.1%.
So I'm listening to you, and you're saying things like, really encouraging, very good, and yet this jobs report came out today, it landed, and then there was a big sell-off in the stock market. What was that?
Right. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled almost 700 points. For investors, the strong job market means the Federal Reserve is going to be in no hurry to cut interest rates. The Fed has already lowered rates by a full percentage point since September, but Fed policymakers have signaled they're going to be very careful about additional rate cuts so long as inflation remains a little bit higher than the central bank would like. Now, if the job market were not holding up so well, the Fed would probably feel more pressure to cut interest rates and goose the economy a little bit. But with today's report painting such a positive picture of the jobs market, Coronado says Fed policymakers can afford to take their time, especially while they wait to see what the incoming president does with economic policy.
They are likely to be patient, particularly given the uncertainties around policies, around immigration and tariffs that might produce a burst of inflation. The Fed can just ride what is a very stable and healthy economy and just gather more information.
Of course, not all stock market investors are known for their patience, and it's the impatient investors who were disappointed today that we're not going to see faster cuts in interest rates.
One more thing to ask you about, Scott, which is this. Why so many people still seem not to be happy about the economy? We know that was a factor in the election in November. How do we square dissatisfaction with the economy with, you're telling me, good jobs numbers, low unemployment?
Yeah, we know there's still a lot of frustration with the cumulative effects of inflation over the last few years. Prices are still high, even if they're no longer going up as fast as they had been. The good news is wages are also going up. In fact, on average, wages have been going up faster than prices for more than a year and a half now. So paychecks are catching up. Workers are regaining some of the buying power they lost when inflation was so high. And today's report is another reminder that a strong job market and low unemployment are working families' best friends. So let's hope they keep up.
Indeed. And Pierre Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Right-wing media and influencers have been blaming the scale of wildfire destruction in Los Angeles on diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. Billionaire Elon Musk and others circulated screenshots of the LA Fire Department's Racial Equity Action Plan. The city's fire chief also happens to be the first woman and openly gay person in that role. The chief, her fire department, and the city government have become targets in right-wing media. NPR's Lisa Hagan reports on how it's part of a wider pattern.
Here's what it sounds like to blame a national tragedy on workplace diversity training. This is Charlie Kirk, founder of the right-wing nonprofit Turning Point USA, on his podcast this week.
When you focus your government on diversity, equity, inclusion, LGBTQ pet projects, and you are captured by environmentalists, we have been warning for years that you are worried about abstractions, but you can't do the basic stuff.
This has become a common refrain for some on the right for all kinds of disasters and tragic events, including the Baltimore Bridge collapse, aircraft safety failures, and the effectiveness of the Secret Service. Stoking anger about diversity efforts is shorthand for a much larger story, according to Ian Haney Lopez.
The story is something like this. We as a society used to hire on the basis of competence and meritocracy, but that system has been hijacked by powerful minorities.
He's a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who focuses on evolving forms of racism.
Again and again, we see these efforts to trigger people's latent resentments against groups that historically have been socially marginalized, socially reviled, but to do so in terms that seek to clothe themselves in a commitment to fairness or excellence.
It's the definition of a dog whistle, he says, and it's taken various forms since at least the end of the Civil War. As for DEI's impact on putting out wildfires,
I give it only slightly more credibility than the Jewish space laser theories.
Mike Beasley is with Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. He fought fires for 40 years and says there are many serious discussions these fires should raise about climate change, funding firefighters, water management, housing development, aging infrastructure. But
no fire agency is going to sacrifice training in fundamental fire control, fundamental operations, at the expense of DEI training.
Lily Zhang has done DEI consulting for 10 years.
The impact of this toxic discourse has been a chilling effect on people's ability to talk about DEI and to communicate their commitment to it.
Zhang says DEI efforts are attempts to push the status quo toward meritocracy, but popular distortions about it and things like critical race theory have been fueled by right-wing think tanks and influencers like Chris Rufo. Here he is on YouTube last year.
We want to say it over and over and over. We want people to be thinking about DEI, people to be debating about DEI, talking about DEI in policy language. But then we want to translate this into a concrete and emotional space.
Here's Zhang again.
And the playbook was very simple. Take some usually progressive or even centrist idea, ideally one that is not well understood, character assassinate it by associating it with everything bad under the sun. It's anti-meritocracy. It's evil.
In LA, investigators are still working to determine what sparked the fires. More of the extreme Santa Ana winds that have made firefighting nearly impossible there are expected to return. Lisa Hagen, NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, announced this week that it is getting rid of fact-checking in the United States. In a video statement, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg laid out the reason, quote, "The fact-checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they have created." The decision raises questions about the type of content that might flourish on Facebook and Instagram going forward, questions that I put today to Michael McConnell. He is co-chair of the Meta Oversight Board, which was established by Meta to review content moderation policies and decisions. Now, Meta is among NPR's sponsors, but we report on them like any other company. So I asked Michael McConnell whether he agreed with Mark Zuckerberg's reasoning.
I think there's a pretty overwhelming evidence that the fact checkers corrected much more content from the right side of the spectrum than the left side of the spectrum. The disagreement is about the reasons why. You know, there's some people, mostly on the left, of course, who say, well, that's because there's so much more misinformation coming from the right. But this is a very difficult thing to measure.
I mean, the origin, as I understand it, of the whole fact-checking program in the first place was the 2016 election, when Russia used Facebook and other platforms, as Facebook has acknowledged, to spread false claims, trying to influence American voters. And we've seen Russia and foreign actors continue to do that in every election since. Do you have concerns about where this could leave us for 2026, 2028?
Well, we'll have to see. I'm not, you know, overly confident that this is going to be the solution. There is really no magic bullet to this problem. But much of this has to do with not the whether the information is true or false, but where it's coming from. So when foreign governments are spreading propaganda, the problem with that is not that it's misinformation, but that it's foreign government propaganda.
We've been talking about challenges with disinformation, with how do you ascertain whether something is quote-unquote true. There are other changes that Zuckerberg announced about Meta lifting some restrictions that were designed to curb hate speech. For example, allowing users to say that LGBTQ people are mentally ill or that women are property. Was there discussion about that on your board? How does that sit with you?
No, this actually came as a surprise to us. We did not know that they were going to be revising that standard.
I mean, I'll let people listening know you're also a law professor at Stanford Law School. And this seems to speak to a natural tension over where the line should be when freedom of expression crosses toward harassment, crosses toward hate speech. I guess I circle back to how Meta is going to navigate that line under this new policy, which, again, you can write that women are property and it's not going to be fact-checked.
I don't know about that particular example because I've actually never seen that particular claim being made. I don't know how it's articulated. But if you look at some of the other...
It's on the Meta's own website, the newly updated policy on hateful conduct. Yeah,
I've never seen an actual example. But some of the examples, I think, are fairly easy to understand. So, for example, they have been taking down a speech that advocates that single-sex spaces be reserved to people who are biologically rather than gender-based of that sex. That's a very raging political debate in the United States, and to take down one side of that does seem to be loading the question.
Can I ask just what's the conversation like on the board these days? Are your meetings contentious?
Oh, yes. I mean, for one thing, the Oversight Board is a global enterprise. And there's a huge difference in the way in which Americans think about freedom of speech and other places around the world. And that really plays out. It's also true that the fact-checking program has been much more contentious and controversial in the United States, not so much elsewhere. So this is a matter of very active and vigorous debate within the board.
Does the timing of this raise any questions in your mind, coming less than 2 weeks before Trump's inauguration?
Well, I'm now speaking just for myself. This is not the oversight board speaking, but I do think that there's bad optics here, that it looks like, and maybe even the reality, I don't know, but it certainly looks like this is buckling to political pressure. I would have liked to have seen these reforms laid out in, you know, in more and less contentious and partisan times, so that they would be considered on the merits rather than looking like this is Donald Trump is president and now they're caving.
Michael McConnell, he is co-chair of Meta's Oversight Board, also a professor at Stanford Law School. Michael McConnell, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
There's still critical fire danger in Southern California, but the howling winds and near constant emergency alerts of the last 3 days are finally slowing down. That's given the majority of Angelenos a chance to catch their breaths, except it's a smoky, unhealthy breath, especially for those who already have breathing problems. NPR's Liz Baker reports.
In a neighborhood under the San Gabriel foothills, Eric Strum has stopped by to check on his home. He's wearing a serious-looking respirator, you know, the kind that make you look like Ant-Man. His house is fine.
Went inside and took off our masks and everything. Smells like smoke, but from what we can tell, other than hot spots in our yard, the home is fine.
He rolls a suitcase down the middle of the street, past smoldering homes, twisted piles of metal that used to be cars, and puddles of blue plastic, the remains of melted garbage bins that now look like modern art. Some of that is in the air now.
There's a lot of chemicals in building materials and in furniture and electronics and cars and all these things that are burning up too. Close exposure to those things we know can be very, very serious.
Pulmonologist Russell Bohr is with UCLA Health.
I mean, I can't even count the number of calls I've gotten since Tuesday from my own patients who are really having a hard time.
He says those with conditions like asthma and COPD, and even people with a history of heart and kidney problems, should be paying close attention to symptoms.
Dizziness, lightheadedness, chest pain, headaches, and kind of being less alert or more drowsy than normal. Those are all things that we would want to get immediate attention for.
That's because wildfire smoke contains tiny particles that are so small they can travel deep into your lungs and into the bloodstream, causing issues from there. Research shows that wildfire smoke is more toxic than other types of air pollution. But most people aren't going to be in serious danger from the smoke today. LA County is huge. 10 million people live here. Many of them will be able to stay inside, run an air purifier, if they have power, or wear an N95 mask. But that's not always an option for those in the smokiest areas, notes Dr. Bohr.
You know, the idea of trying to shelter in place just isn't a reality in something like a wildfire. And so being able to protect yourself when you're displaced is even more challenging.
He says these fires are the worst he's seen in his 25 years practicing in LA. And he worries that as scenarios like this become more common with climate change, so too will the panicked calls from patients looking for help breathing. Liz Baker, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
After 4 years on the job, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is preparing to return to life as a civilian. We sat down with him to talk about the Biden administration's Historic Infrastructure Act and why it didn't seem to resonate with voters.
A lot of the things that we work on are worth doing, whether they're getting you a lot of political credit or not.
That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Football fans know the season can feel like a soap opera.
For their fan base, like, it's not confusion, but it's kind of, I don't know what to do with my hands because we have not been in this situation before.
The playoffs are here and we're breaking down the biggest stories after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President-elect Donald Trump has been sentenced in his criminal hush money case. New York Judge Juan Merchan cited the protections of Office of the Presidency as he explained his ruling today.
This court has determined that the only lawful sentence that permits entry of a judgment of conviction without encroaching upon the highest office in the land is an unconditional discharge.
That means Trump will face no jail time, fines, or any other penalties for his crimes. Shortly after the judge's decision, Trump defended himself, saying the entire case was politically motivated.
It was done to damage my reputation so that I'd lose the election, and obviously that didn't work. And the people of our country got to see this firsthand because they watched the case in your courtroom.
Trump was convicted on 34 felony counts for falsifying business records to cover up a hush money payment made to an adult film star ahead of the 2016 election. Trump had repeatedly tried to get the case thrown out, but failed. President Biden says he's in close contact with city and state officials as deadly wildfires continue to rage across Los Angeles County.
While the winds have died down for the time, we expect they'll remain a threat until early next week. So we're going to keep working 24/7 to support state and local officials to fully stop these fires as soon as possible.
The death toll has risen to at least 11 as fire crews work around the clock to contain the blazes. Entire neighborhoods have burned to the ground with more than 10,000 structures destroyed, including thousands of homes and businesses. Stocks closed sharply on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 696 points. The Nasdaq fell 317. This is NPR News in Washington. The Biden administration is imposing sweeping sanctions on Russia's energy industry. NPR's Jackie Northam reports the move targets what administration officials say is the largest source of revenue for Russia's war against Ukraine.
Administration officials say this latest round of sanctions targets some of Russia's largest oil companies, as well as traders, oil field service providers, and liquefied natural gas projects. Administration officials say this new round of sanctions will cost Russia billions of dollars in energy reserves. The move by the Biden administration comes just days before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. He's been skeptical of imposing new sanctions on Russia. The U.S. has slapped more than 5,000 sanctions and export controls on Russia since the invasion of Ukraine almost 3 years ago. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The White House says hundreds of thousands of people from Venezuela and El Salvador who are living in the U.S. legally under temporary protected status can remain in the country. The declaration could be reversed when President-elect Donald Trump takes office later this month. TPS designation gives people the legal right to be in the United States based on security or humanitarian crises in their home country. I'm Windsor Johnston, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3 AI, C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. TikTok had its day in front of the Supreme Court today. Because of a law that Congress passed last year, the viral video app could be banned in 9 days unless the High Court intervenes. Arguing on behalf of the U.S. government, the Justice Department said if TikTok does not cut its ties to China, then shutting down the app will be necessary to protect national security. NPR's Bobby Allen was in the courtroom today. He is in our studio right now. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, start with lawyers for TikTok. What did they argue to the Supreme Court?
You know, they painted a dire picture. They said the app will go dark a week from Sunday unless the Supreme Court steps in. Now, this could affect 170 million people. That's half of the U.S. population that use TikTok every day. And in their bid to keep TikTok alive, the company's legal team argued that its algorithm, which curates content, is actually a type of protected speech. So TikTok's U.S. operation is having its speech rights infringed by this law. TikTok says so too are the millions of creators who would be silenced by this ban.
Now, we already noted to what TikTok's problem has been all through this. It's China, in a word, because TikTok's parent company is based there. How did TikTok address that in court?
Yeah, they did it in a pretty outlandish way. TikTok's lawyer made this comparison. What if China had influence over a newspaper, say the Washington Post? TikTok's lawyer, Noel Francisco, said, imagine if China kidnapped Post owner Jeff Bezos' kids and demanded to control the paper's front page stories. Would Congress shut down the Post then?
I still don't think that Congress could come in and tell Bezos either sell the Post or shut it down, because that would violate Bezos's rights and the Washington Post's rights.
Likewise, Francisco says the same applies to TikTok, and he asked the court to block the law or at least pause the start date.
Bobby, I'm racing to imagine how Justice Department lawyers would have responded to that. How did they respond?
Yeah, the Justice Department said the law Congress passed was intended to remove China's ability to get Americans' data. And the law did this by requiring TikTok to just fully cut ties with China or be shut down. The Justice Department's position was China is an enemy of the United States, not just any foreign country we're talking about here. China has a voracious appetite for Americans' data and wants to sow chaos in the U.S., they said. And TikTok could be used to pursue those interests. Here's how Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar explained why ByteDance needs to be severed from TikTok.
It's like patching up a backdoor vulnerability that the PRC has that we can't totally see around all the corners to imagine how it could use it against our interests.
PRC, of course, being the People's Republic of China.
Right. Okay. So the Supreme Court justices who were listening along to all this, how did they react?
All the justices appeared pretty skeptical that TikTok's free speech rights are more important than overseas threats. Some worried that TikTok could collect personal information on teenage users who, as adults, might work in the military or the federal government. Then the information could be used against them as blackmail. Other justices voiced concerns about China pushing propaganda on the app. This is how Chief Justice John Roberts responded to TikTok's legal team, drawing a distinction between TikTok's U.S. operations and its parent company in China.
It seems to me that you're ignoring the major concern here of Congress, which was Chinese manipulation of the content and acquisition and harvesting of the content.
Okay. So, Bobby, what happens now?
So we're waiting to hear if the court is going to delay the ban's start date and then also when it will rule on the merits, which will be in the coming days. And of course, there was President-elect Donald Trump, who has vowed to save TikTok. And that might throw another wrench into this situation. It all, Mary Louise, might just come down to the wire.
And Pierre's Bobby Allen. Thank you.
Thank you.
The fall of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad has had an impact beyond Syria.
Turkey, Syria's neighbor to the north, has been hosting over 3 million Syrian refugees for over a decade. Now, at least 50,000 Syrians have left Turkey since the Assad regime fell. That's according to Turkish authorities. But many others are still hesitant about going home. NPR's Fatma Tanis visited the Turkey-Syria border and joins us now from Gaziantep, which is in southern Turkey. Hi there.
Hi.
So Fatma, start by just telling us a bit about the scene at the border and what you heard from Syrians.
You know, I saw a stream of Syrian families being dropped off at the border crossing by taxi or by friends. They had mountains of luggage with them. Some had even brought refrigerators or air conditioners to take back to Syria. These are the ones who were planning to go back for good. There was a lot of excitement, a lot of joy. One elderly woman I spoke to, Huria Kamaluddin, she couldn't hold back tears when I asked her why she wanted to go back. Life has been good here, but it's enough. Our homeland is calling us, she says. She and her husband were going back together, but her kids and her grandchildren are staying here in Turkey. Other people told me they're leaving because of rising costs of living here. And some had special permits to check out the situation in Syria. The Turkish government has allowed each refugee family to visit Syria up to 3 times before they make a final decision. Now, what I heard from authorities at the border, though, was that the number of returnees has slowed down over the past couple of weeks.
What have you heard from Syrians who are not choosing to go back immediately?
So I've been talking to Syrians in several cities in Turkey over the past month, and nearly all told me they wanted to eventually go back. But they had various concerns. Syria is still not a united country. There's potential for conflict, they said. Some cited the lack of basic resources like electricity, running water, housing, jobs. And many Syrian families have children who spent most of their lives in Turkey. They don't speak Arabic. They don't feel connected to their parents' homeland. And that's another hurdle for Syrian families.
What have you heard from Turkish citizens? How are they reacting to all of this?
Many here want the refugees to go back. There's been a big shift among the Turkish public, which had initially welcomed the refugees with open arms back in 2012. But no one expected that they'd be here so long, and not even the refugees themselves. And when the Turkish economy took a turn for the worse a few years ago, we saw that shift in public opinion. You know, refugees here are entitled to benefits like free healthcare and education. And recently, tensions within the Turkish public reached a boiling point. We started to see more and more cases of racism and discrimination against Syrians here. But Juana, what's interesting now, though, is that after the fall of Assad, when all the news reports came out about the torture in the prisons and the mass graves, there's been some sympathy for Syrians. I've heard this from both Turks and Syrians. There's this new understanding of why they had to be here all these years. But how long that's going to last is unclear.
Right. And how does this impact the Turkish government's approach to Syria?
Well, a big part of Turkish strategy in Syria is to support an environment where refugees can return to. The Turkish government is doing everything it can for the new administration in Damascus to survive. It backed the Syrian opposition for years, and it now enjoys influence over the new leadership. This week, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized opposition figures in Turkey who were pushing for a forced return of Syrian refugees. He said that people would have a choice, but analysts say it might take years for Syria to stabilize and years for refugees to return home.
That's NPR's Fatma Tanis reporting from southern Turkey. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. With 10 days left in office, the Biden administration is taking steps to protect some immigrants. Today, the president extended temporary protected status for migrants in the U.S. from a handful of countries, including El Salvador, Venezuela, and Ukraine. About 1 million people will be shielded from deportation for up to 18 months. However, many are fearful that President-elect Donald Trump could change that. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports.
For the last few months, Carlos Argueta has traveled to Washington, D.C. to advocate for the preservation of temporary protected status, or TPS, for people from El Salvador. The designation, which is given to people from certain countries that are unsafe to return to, was set to expire in March. Argueta is 51 and lives in Houston, where he works as a tax preparer. He's lived in the U.S. since 2000 and was driving to work this morning when he learned the Biden administration had extended TPS for his homeland.
Muy contento y agradecido con él porque lo va a dar la.
He says he's grateful Biden is giving him and the nearly 234,000 other beneficiaries from El Salvador the chance to remain in the country and renew their work permit. Biden also extended TPS to about 600,000 Venezuelans and 100,000 Ukrainians. TPS was created by Congress in 1990 as part of the Immigration Act. That year, El Salvador became the first country to be granted TPS for two consecutive years due to the civil war. It was renewed in 2001 after a series of devastating earthquakes and has been extended since. Ana is 69 years old and has been a beneficiary of TPS for 24 years.
Y desde esa fecha yo no he dejado de solicitarlo, de llenar mis papeles, hacer mis taxas.
Ana says she has to reapply for TPS every 18 months. She works as a janitor cleaning offices in Houston and religiously files her taxes. But she doesn't want me to use her last name because she's scared of being targeted if President-elect Donald Trump revokes TPS for El Salvador.
Una idea muy que no creo asimilarlo, ¿me entiende? Porque
she says she can't fathom having to return to El Salvador at her age. Trump tried during his first term to end TPS for hundreds of thousands of people from six countries, including El Salvador, but was blocked in the courts. The Trump-Vance transition team didn't respond to questions about Biden's actions or their plans for TPS, but Trump's incoming border czar, Tom Homan, has said the program could be slashed. According to the Department of Homeland Security, 17 countries currently have TPS designation. Jose Palma is a coordinator with the National TPS Alliance, an organization that advocates for legislation that would allow TPS holders to get permanent status.
I have four U.S. citizen kids. Some of my kids are in the university, some of my kids are in middle school, getting into elementary school and middle school. So the impact of losing TPS will not only be on myself, but in the families. And this is the situation for everyone protected by TPS.
Including Walter Martinez, a hotel worker in Las Vegas. He says he's relieved that Biden extended the TPS for El Salvador, but he's expecting Trump to take it away.
No sé cuánto tiempo nos van a dar. Y si Trump nos va a poner al frente de la línea para poder ser deportados.
He says he worries Trump will put TPS holders at the front of the line in his mass deportation plans. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Austin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. If you're a football fan, fall and winter can often feel like a soap opera. There's heartbreak, there's rivalry, revenge, falls from grace, and of course, every so often, the brightest, most wonderful, most fleeting joy that you can imagine.
We've made it back to the playoffs! Yes!
Tom Grassi has been making NFL content on YouTube for almost a decade, and last season, he started parodying every weekly twist and turn in his If the NFL Was Scripted series, where he plays the NFL scriptwriter, plus the ref, plus every NFL team as himself.
I believe you need somebody else to win in order for your team to make it to the playoffs.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. It looks like I have all the power here.
I mean, I could just ask the scriptwriter, so...
The power to create or destroy.
I really don't have time for this. Dolphins lose, they retain all their coaches, and Tyreek Hill changes his profile picture to Antonio Brown.
Good luck.
And just like that, my power is gone.
Well, as the NFL playoffs get underway with Wild Card Weekend, we decided to ask Tom how he thinks it will go down if he were truly the NFL scriptwriter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
Before we get into the playoffs and how you would script it, I do want to just start with the series. Where did you first get this idea?
So I came up with this week two of the 2023 and 2024 NFL season. And it was after Aaron Rodgers went down, and that was like a Monday night, and the whole air got sucked out of MetLife Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
But around that time, like, there was like the jokes about it being scripted. So I put out like a 7-8 minute video, and it blew up. I was like, you know what? I really think that I could take what's going on within the league and say, hey, I can do kind of this recap while also making it entertaining and funny, and kind of putting my own little spin on it.
Yeah. All right, so let's put that persona to work. What is the hottest plot line for you going into the first round?
Listen, you know, when it comes to the Green Bay Packers, of course, I will always, always be optimistic in thinking that they can beat the Philadelphia Eagles. But I think the bigger plot line is going to be what happens with the Detroit Lions and what happens with, like, the Chiefs. Because the Chiefs, we all know, is the NFL scriptwriter's favorite.
Right.
And so it's just going to be a matter of, can the Chiefs finally, finally lose? And if they do lose, what is the reason why? Because the scriptwriter's got to have a pretty good reason for the Kansas City not to go all the way. But if the Chiefs were to lose in the Super Bowl, I think just the sigh of relief that would come from a good chunk of the nation watching of, oh, we don't have to watch the same team win it three times in a row, would be pretty spectacular. The only other one I think could be beat is if in the AFC Championship game, you have the Bills finally, finally knock off the Chiefs. They could do it in the regular season all these years, but they can never get it done. And if the Bills or the Ravens could finally get it done, I mean, I don't know if there's a better storyline than that.
I trust that you can put your Packers fandom aside as we talk about another NFC North team.
Of course.
Lions, right? Historically bad, like decades-long
yes.
joke of the NFL. They've had this recent resurgence. This year, it seems to all be coming together. In your non-biased, again, opinion, what do you think the perfect ending is for a team like the Lions?
I mean, their perfect ending is winning the Super Bowl. And I've talked to a lot of Lions fans. I've talked to Lions fans where they didn't win a single game in a calendar year, which is very bad. Then they went through some really bad coaches. And ultimately, they got Dan Campbell, and they've been drafting well. They won two playoff games last year, and they went to the NFC Championship game and almost won that if they didn't blow it in the third quarter. So this year, the expectations were, okay, we won our playoff game, we won our division, now we want to be contending for a Super Bowl. And things were looking really good, and then everybody got injured, especially on the defensive side of the ball. Now, for them to go out and beat the Vikings on Sunday Night Football, the last regular season game, their defense looked great. They got some guys back from injury, and now they're supposed to get even more folks back from injury. For their fan base, like it's not confusion, but it's kind of, I don't know what to do with my hands because we have not been in this situation before.
I want to ask you about one more big storyline for the playoffs, and that's a storyline that people always love, and that's a rookie quarterback, right?
Mm.
You've got Bo Nix and the Broncos, you've got Jaden Daniels and the Commanders, both in the playoffs. Both of these teams have had these real Cinderella story years. What do you think should happen?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, for the Broncos, it's just super impressive because they were being considered as one of the worst teams heading into this year. They had a ton of dead cap because they just got rid of Russell Wilson, their former quarterback that they made a big trade for, and to come in with a rookie quarterback and a great defense and to make it to the seventh seed, they arguably have the toughest road ahead because they're going up against the Bills, who are a very good football team, they're going to have to beat their former Super Bowl champion, former player in Von Miller, who is now with the Bills. So that's a fantastic storyline there. And then for Jaden Daniels, they're going up against Baker Mayfield. That matchup in of itself, the Commanders versus the Buccaneers, is, hey, you have this rookie quarterback in Jaden Daniels, who is likely going to win Offensive Rookie of the Year. He's been having a great year, versus a quarterback that a lot of people forgot about or kind of wrote off. That's always the entertaining storylines, because that's the stuff that goes beyond football, right? Because it's like, oh, you would get invested in the people and the individuals and the players and their story and their journey. And that's what makes this sport, you know, one of the best ones in the world.
One other thing I want to ask you in terms of how you think about the stuff you put out, right? In any given week, half of the fans watching you will have just been crushed by a loss. They might be in a bad mood.
Yes.
How do you think about creating content that's fun, that's friendly, that brings people along in a space where I think you are well aware that is often not the case, right? When it comes to sports content, to football content especially. Like, how do you think about that? How do you make that work?
The first video I did was in 2015, me reacting to the Packers losing in the NFC Championship game against the Seahawks, which, if you're not aware of that game, it is one of the, oh boy, most heartbreaking games if you're a Packers fan, because they were 5 minutes away from going to the Super Bowl, and they just blew it. And 2 days later, I made a video because I was like, if I wasn't a Packers fan, the amount of things that went wrong would just be funny. And fans were reaching out to me, and Packers fans, and they were like, hey, like, this was the first time I've laughed in a couple of days. And what I did for all these years is every single week, I interviewed a fan from the opposing team. And so I talked to Lions fans twice a year. I talked to Browns fans. I talked to Panthers fans. I talked to fans who, you know, a good season for them is to have a winning record. And here I am complaining about, you know, when my team loses it in the second biggest game of the year, right? So it kind of gave me this perspective. And I think the other thing that just when it comes in terms of creating is just being able to be accurate with how each fan base is feeling. Like, I always wanted to create like a very accepting, everybody's welcome. There's just like this baseline of like, don't be that person that's going to ruin it for everybody. Football is just my thing of I love the game and I love everything around it, because I think it really can create an awesome community.
That is Tom Grossi, creator of If the NFL Was Scripted and so much other NFL content over at YouTube. Thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the playoffs.
Scott, really appreciate you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at AU.org/.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
All righty, everybody. This is Virgil. This is KSDP. We will have high school basketball coming to you live. Our first game tonight is the boys. We've got the Sandpoint Gentlemen Eagles and the King Cove T-Jacks. They are up at the Sandpoint School, and we have a start-off time at 6 p.m. Austin Roof will be bringing you the play-by-play. And then after that, we'll be going to Chris Babcock in King Cove, Alaska, from the King Cove School. And he'll be bringing you the ladies, the rookies, and the Lady Eagles. In the meantime, Miranda Lambert, if I was a cowboy And we'll be bringing you coverage here in just a moment.